And here is your host, Austin Barker.
Well, good morning, everybody. It's Wednesday, and you know what that means. It's Wednesday morning at 7 o'clock, and so it's time to settle yourselves in for 2 hours. If I can hold on to my phone, it's my brain is what I almost said. Who am I? I'm Austin Barker, and I'm glad you're here this morning. Welcome to the show, and we will be doing it for 2 hours this morning. Please get your phones ready and answer my questions, because that's who I am. But I have been thinking, well, okay, I'll tell you this first. There's a contest. If you want to participate in a contest on Facebook, it's on my Facebook page, which is Austin and Megan Barker. Should I tell people personal information like that over the radio? It's okay.
Too late now. And it's on the podcast.
I have nothing to hide. I put up a contest. This is the second one that I'm running now. A couple weeks ago, let's see, it was my wife Megan's birthday, and so I got her a pergola, one of those kind of prefab pergolas from Lowe's, and brought it home, and it needed to be assembled. Some assembly required, it said. And so I think there was a rain day involved in that, and I wasn't out working, I wasn't out gardening, and so the pergola got assembled. That's the use of the passive voice that we use as English teachers. We use that to conceal the identity of the person who actually did the action, but the action was that the pergola got assembled. So we took pictures of my oldest son, Peter, 11-year-old, and of me, and of my wife, Megan, all in the action of drilling or screwing in these screws to assemble the pergola. And then I posted it to Facebook and said, who was the person who actually assembled this pergola? Surprise, surprise. Most people that I'm friends with on Facebook and that chose to participate, most people guessed. Gary, go ahead. Say, who did they guess?
You.
Incorrect.
Austin did it.
Incorrect. That is the truth. I actually did 80% of it. Megan was there with me when I started the project. Uh-huh. And Peter was there with me when I started the project. So we all kind of participated. But within a few minutes, Megan got distracted and headed off into her garden to do something. And so I did the lion's share of the assembly. Mm-hmm. But everyone guessed Megan. I don't know what that says about me. I don't know what that says about what people think about me. But I decided to make it easier. So now with the snow, and I think it was last Friday, I don't remember why, because I was working. I had time to work, but I figured, well, we'll come back to my property and do some projects. So me and my employee, or my employee and I, since I'm an English teacher, dug some fence post holes for my wife. And I used this auger, auger, man, it's this diggy thing, you know, that has this spiral big tool, and it's kind of a beastly machine. And so I dug all the holes and whatever, and then we did the thing again, and I took pictures of Megan like holding the auger, you know, like this, and then I took a video of me doing it, and I posted that to my Facebook, and said, who actually, let's see, I said, back by popular demand, round two of our guess who really did the work guessing game. Since so many of y'all were all so keen to guess that it was Megan who actually assembled the pergola, let's see if you can get this one right. Who actually did the work of augering these fence holes for the wood fence we will soon be installing in the backyardish area, Megan or Austin? And I posted a video of me doing it and a picture of her posing. Let's see if people can get this one right, huh? Anyway, I don't know. They'll probably still guess Megan. It's really, if I wasn't so secure in my masculinity, it might bother me. So,
but how do you feel that I picked you?
Well, thank you, Gary. That you probably know you did that because I control your job. So
and I know you a little bit more than Megan. You bring Megan in once in a while so
goodness.
I can get to know her.
You know
then
what,
I would pick her.
People said that it was because of the expression on her face that she was wearing in the pergola picture. Like she was wearing an actual working face.
Oh, wow.
You know, she had that, I think she had her tongue out left to the left,
like Michael Jordan.
You gotta hold your tongue right. All right, so that's that. Do you think that curiosity and wisdom are in tension with each other? You're like, what in the world? So here's the deal, okay? I just finished reading the Divergent, book one of the Divergent series by somebody who, Veronica Roth, I think, if I'm remembering correctly, but that's just off the top of my head. I listened to the audio of it, which raises another question that I want to ask you in a minute. Is listening to an audiobook, does that count as reading a book? Can you say after having listened to a book, can you say, I recently read such and such a book? some people feel an obsessive need to qualify that and say, well, I actually didn't read it, I listened to it. Is the qualifier necessary there? I want to dig into that a little bit and tell you why I think that those two things are different. But in this book, if you haven't read the book and seen the movie, maybe at least the scenes, I haven't watched the movie. I watched some scenes from the movie after I read them listened to them in the audiobook. I went to YouTube and just watched certain scenes from the movie that I had read about. And to be fair, most of the scenes, major scenes that I wanted to go see from the movies were very, like, remarkably similar to the books. Now, there's probably some stuff that gets left out in the movie, because there always is. Sometimes there's stuff that's added, and almost inevitably there's stuff that's changed. Why? I don't know. But nonetheless, so the movies, if you have seen them, and if you can tell me, are the movies similar enough to the books to where we can talk about them in the same conversation? Which is not the case with Lord of the Rings or Narnia, the three Narnia movies that they did before they decided that it was a completely unprofitable venture for them. Hold on, I'm going to take a drink of coffee. That's good. Life's good. So in the Divergent book, it's a dystopian science fiction, which is my preferred genre. And so in this future world, the social order, which is based in Chicago, a futuristic dystopian Chicago, the world has been broken down by war. And so all dystopian science fiction novels have to answer the question, what went wrong to create this dystopian future? You know, what was the source of the war, and how did the world break, and what is now being done to create a new order, social order? In the new social order, the society has been divided into five factions. And those factions are, if I can just rehearse them from the top of my head, the factions were formed in response to what was perceived to be the great social evil, like the thing that caused the world to break. What do you consider to be the prime vice? And in response to that, these five factions were formed, where people who are dispositionally committed to the opposite virtue can find a purpose and can find a role in society by exercising that virtue. So the five virtues are these: candor, which is the opposite of duplicity. So duplicity would have been the main thing that these people think is the problem with the world. Okay, the problem with our politics is that people lie all the time. So we should tell the truth, candor. Another one is erudite, which would be a synonym for intelligent. They believe that ignorance is the prime vice. And so education is the path to happiness and prosperity, or learning, knowledge. All right, that's erudite. And then abnegation, which is like humility. So they believe, abnegation believes that selfishness is the root cause of social evil. And so they are committed to selflessness or abnegation. There is amity, which is basically friendship or peace-loving people. And they believe that aggression is the prime evil. And so they are committed to amity or getting along. And then there is, what's the other one? Dauntless, of course. Which believe that cowardice is the prime social evil. And so they are committed to things like courage and fearlessness. So having divided into those five factions, each of those factions carries a role in the society. Obviously, erudite would do the education and the learning component, and dauntless does the defense component for the society, and that's complicated, but abnegation does the service components. Amity does all the farming and the food supply and the transportation and stuff like that. All right, so having said all that, my initial reaction, which was confirmed by the theme of the book near the end, my initial reaction was, this is too one-dimensional. You can't make people into one-dimensional virtuous people, okay? We're not that simple. You can't just say, I'm going to ally myself with the dauntless faction, and so I'm going to define my life by courage. Well, you also need all these other virtues as well. You also need a commitment to learning, a lifelong learning. You also need an amity or an ability to get along with other people. You also need selflessness. You also need all these other things. And so that was almost immediately, as soon as I started reading the book and I got the gist of the thing, like, this is what it's about, I said, yeah, this is too one-dimensional. And to the author's credit, that was her strong critique of a society organized by that. Okay, she came up with that idea and then said, this is why that doesn't work, because I'm the main character was who's one of the main characters whose name was Four, said, he said, I want to embody the virtues of all the factions. So that was good. But it got me to thinking about virtues and vices in tension with each other. And so this is what I got to thinking about curiosity and wisdom, because curiosity is a feature of erudite. And curiosity, boy, I'm a curious person. If you know anything about me, you know that I ask honest questions. That's my whole shtick, okay, is that I ask honest questions. I'm not going to avoid or veer away from or suppress or ignore any honest question. If I've got it, I'm going to ask it. And I always have them, because I tell my kids, when we're reading a book, good readers ask good questions, and good authors write in such a way that they prompt the asking of good questions. And so that, though, in any organization or in any context, the asking of honest questions is a destabilizing proposition. Like, whenever you ask a question and you're not asking a leading question or a rhetorical question, which is just a question, which is just a statement masquerading as a question, okay, it's just a statement in disguise. I don't ask leading questions. I'm not headed somewhere with my question. I'm like, what's the answer here? What's the truth? I'm in pursuit of truth at the end of that question. Now, that truth could come from any direction, and so because of that, I've opened up the issue to the possibility of change. That's destabilizing. Questions are destabilizing. Do you agree so far? Can you be both wise and curious at the same time? I hope so, because I aspire to both. And having read the Divergent series, I think it's unwise to presume that even virtues in tension with each other cannot coexist in the same person. I don't know exactly how all that happens, but the Barker Creed says that life is best lived curious. Learning never stops, ever. That's one plank of our creed. And another of our planks says that Barkers seek to be wise, balanced, and gracious in our opinions and appetites. Barkers avoid extremes. So maybe the answer is just not to be too curious, or to know when to be curious and when to stifle curiosity. And so I guess that would be the wise exercise of curiosity. I believe that it's Ecclesiastes that says that there's a time and place for everything under heaven, right? There's a time to build, there's a time to tear down. There's a time to go to war, there's a time to make peace. There's a time to cry, and there's a time to laugh. And maybe I could add to the list, there's a time to be curious, and then there's a time not to be curious. There's a time for questions, and there's a time for answers. I've given you my best shot at it. If you think that you can do better, call me and tell me what is exactly the relationship between wisdom and curiosity. So one of my favorite things to do, favorite pastime, is to look at the generation below me and tell them they're going to hell. That's not entirely true, but it's partially true. And I'm interested to know if it's true for you. I happen to know that most listeners to this radio show are over 50 years old. Okay? How do I know that? Well, because frankly, people younger than that are on their phones. And I suppose they could listen to the His Radio, is it hisradiotalk.com, or the streaming app. You can get that on your phone, but I don't think that's where the bulk of our listenership comes from. And on the podcast, that I could actually see the demographic breakdown of the people who are listening. at least as best they've reported it, as accurately as they've reported it. So if you're under 50 and listening to this show, I believe that you're in the minority. So, but let me ask both categories of listener, those over 50 and those under 50, are today's kids going to survive? Like, legit, I guess what I don't mean is survive, and what I do mean is, like, live in any recognizable way that we would call life, living life, like quality life. Because I'm raising six kids, and people look at me a lot and say, wow, that's a really brave thing to do, is to have that many kids in today's world. What does that mean? What does that mean in today's world? As though, is this world that we live in today? I'm asking an honest question, okay? I'm not asking a leading question. I want to know what is meant by, in today's world, it's a very, air quotes, bold thing to have six kids because dot, dot, dot. Because what? What's the risk to kids to having a big family now, or to having kids at all today, that was not true in previous generations? What's the answer to that? I'm just going to leave that question hanging for you, and I want you to tell me what the answer to that question is, okay? Because if you look at the things that the older generation would tend to grind their teeth at the younger generation, and there's this quote out there that is not legitimately attributed to Plato. It is attributed to Plato, but I do not believe it is legitimate. I don't think that he said it. But he said that the old have always some that criticized the young. Okay? I definitely think that's true. I'm not a big believer in the good old days, because back in the good old days, there was the good old days. And so in a previous era, they looked back to previous eras as being the good old days. So that, to me, tells me that the good old days is a moving target. And all it means is 30 years ago or 50 years ago, or in some cases, in some extreme cases, 100 years ago. I don't buy that. And so I'm wondering if this whole, you know, today's generation's going to hell, I'm wondering if that is in the same category as the good old days, a comfortable myth. I'll pause there. I have more questions and more points to make. But I'll pause there and welcome Gary to the show this morning. Good morning. Gary, are you there? Do you want to dial Gary up? Hang tight, Gary. We'll get you up. Do you have Gary's volume?
Is there a tension between wisdom and curiosity?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's easier to look at a pair like contentment and ambition. And those are clearly in tension with one another.
Yeah.
And it's hard, and it takes wisdom to know how to balance your being content with being ambitious to always press forward and do better, but maybe I should just relax and be content. I think you can have both of those in the same person,
mm-hmm.
and absolutely curiosity and wisdom. I think it's wise to be curious, so I don't see those necessarily quite as in tension as things like ambition and contentment. And then your most recent comments were kind of about the degradation of morals, is how I see it.
Mm-hmm.
it is getting worse. If you study history and you experience the present and you look at the trends of things that are going. But even though there is a degradation of morals, I do not personally think that the current generation is headed completely into destruction. I have enough hope, which, you know, is in contrast with my cynicism. My skepticism is in tension with my hope. I have a lot of trust and hope that God's sovereignty will call enough young leaders. If you look around, you'll find young people who are absolutely amazing, and that God will lead them into leadership, they may lead this generation in a better direction.
That's interesting. Can I query that just a little bit, Gary? Will you stay on the line with me for just a second?
Sure.
All right.
Sure.
So you're talking about morally you talked about the moral degradation, okay? And you talked about trends, which is super, super important to me. And as usual, I love your insights, okay? The reason that I follow headlines and the reason that I enjoy listening to old commentators, and by old, I'm tongue-in-cheek, I'm putting that over 50, okay? I like listening to people who have been observing culture for a while, because what they can see is they can see the trends. They know history either because they experienced it or they're closer to it, all right? So they can see trends in a way that young commentators, and I'm going to put myself in that category, don't necessarily see that. Now, I like listening to young people because they have a better grasp on what's going on today. So there's the benefit of age that gives you perspective, and then there's the benefit of youth that gives you relevance and intensity of the now. All right? I'm getting to my exact question that I want to ask you. So what is the trend line? It seems like you're indicating that the trend line is down. And that would be validated by a headline that I read from the Greenville News about how there's been another fraternity banned from Clemson for morally degrading behavior. Okay? They use that word. Those aren't mine. Morally degrading behavior. My question, Gary, is this a ebb and flow, or is this a straight-up decline into ruin?
That's a good question. So let's think about this for a minute. I think there are ebbs and flows always. The question is whether the ebbs and flows are on a progressive downward level or upward tilt. So if you picture waves going up and down, they might, on average, be a rising trend or descending or steady. And it looks to me like there is a general degradation of overall morals in our society, but there is an increasing growth of the Church of Jesus Christ in areas of the world that used to not have any Christians at all. And so there, you know, if you take a more global view, there may be more of an ebb and flow going on than an overall decline. And there come times where there's a crisis point or a major change, a step change, where a leader that's an amazing person that's gifted by God comes and makes a huge impact. And that's where my hope for the future and current generations lie, is that leaders might be raised up by God to speak to our culture and to change culture, like the grassroots folks who are being encouraged to run for school boards and get into people like Josh Kimbrell, who, you know, I used to listen to come in. He'd come in as a guest when he was a student at North Greenville,
mm-hmm.
and now he's a state senator.
Mm-hmm.
There's these flashlights in society,
mm-hmm.
and I think it's incumbent on us to pray for the God of the harvest, the God who is harvesting, to send laborers into the field and to keep up our hope, but also have a sober view that, you know, we need to take action because there is a decline. So that's kind of how I look at it.
Wow, that's really something. Gary, always appreciate your call and your wisdom and your contributions here. Good morning, Gene. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I wanted to comment on Gary's point, but before I do that, I wanted to respond to your comment regarding the rearing of six children in a family,
mm-hmm.
and the perception that people out there, I think this is what you said, the perception out there that what you and your wife have done is very, very peculiar for our time. Is that what you were telling us?
I said brave, but yeah, it seems like people go, whoa, whenever I tell them that
right.
I have six kids.
But there's a component that you missed in all this that needs to be emphasized, and this is something that my wife and I go through.
Mm-hmm.
in our particular situation, which I might want to tell you what it is. I'm 71. My wife is 68. We have at home a 43-year-old mentally retarded. I call him boy. He's a boy. He has the Fragile X syndrome. Mm-hmm. People think they're strange. I think he's strange too. But there's a heart of love here that we cannot separate, and people look at us as strange, particularly since I'm blind. Now we have another element to this too. When I tell them, my wife and I have been married now since 1976. We're talking about, we're about to go on to 46 years. That draws even a bigger response that, wow. So this is what you have to meld in your situation. Not only is it the six children, it's the marriage. Because I want to tell you, there are many people of your age and your generation and younger that have six children, but not by the same parents. And that's the tragedy of America today, or perhaps the world today, that the family structure has been destroyed. And this structure that I'm referring to is further destroyed by government policies. And now you come to the question of, well, will we have an optimistic future? And Gary, before, just mentioned that, oh, he's optimistic that a leader is going to come by as a flashing light. And, yeah, there have been folks that have come by, and that's wonderful. But you know what? The door is now open. That door is open for the great deception. And his name is called the, you know who it is, right?
Mm-hmm. The Pope. Antichrist. The Pope, right? No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, well, the Pope may very well be part of that as the, the beast of the earth.
Oh,
the beast
my
of the
goodness.
Earth and the beast of the sea. The beast
I just
the
made
sea.
A whole bunch of people mad,
is,
so that's fine. I'm kidding.
I'm not an optimist. I'm a pessimist in that regard because I see what's going on, and we need only look at a wise man, I think, will look at the patterns of history in the past. And this is something I tell many people. You want to have a projection of the future? Look at the history of nations of the past. One paramount in that regard is Rome. What happened in Roman culture at their demise, at their downfall? Well, America has all those features.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Gene. I appreciate it. All right. So Gary made the point that that yes, there's an ebb and flow, and a global view may help us bring clarity to whether or not this is a straight up decline, and we're looking at a culture in its death throes, or if this is just the natural ebb and flow of history. He kind of proposed the possibility that this is an ebb and flow that is in a general downward direction, so that the flows are not as high as the previous flow. The peaks are getting lower and the troughs are getting lower. That is generally a pessimistic view of history, but his hope was what I found interesting. He contrasted his trust and hope were the words that he used versus he used cynicism, and then he backed off of that a little bit and said skepticism with a belief in God's sovereign control of history. And it almost seemed like he was proposing a floor. Like, even though this is an ebb and flow, the troughs have a floor beneath which they cannot sink, or God will not allow them to sink because God will raise up a person who will salvage the thing. Or as Uncle Bud Robinson would say, he said, things are getting nicky. He said, God always comes through in the nick of time, and it seems like it's getting nickier and nickier. I kind of like that quote. But I'm not, I don't think, as optimistic as Gary about the prospects for this generation, although I do agree that with Thomas Sowell that there's no such thing as solution, there's just trade-offs. And so, you know, with the rise in technology, we have seen many benefits accrue from our technology. We have also seen many demerits accrue to our society from the same. And my question is, I mean, it's possible to trade up, right? I mean, you could exchange one set of vices for a lesser set of vices. But it's also possible to trade down. And I'm suggesting that we've probably traded down. Let me just make a laundry list for you, okay? This is just some of the problems facing our children nowadays. And I'll put this in a Western context. It may or may not be true more globally. But the West is in educational decline. Like, our institutions at every level of the educational system are in full-on rot mode. I've taught at multiple schools, multiple types of schools in multiple states. And I'll just tell you that the reason I'm not teaching, one of two reasons that I'm not teaching, is because of the kids and because of the deterioration in the quality of the character of the kids. Okay? That I can't run a classroom the way a classroom should be run, because there's a complete lack of respect for authority. There is just an unresponsiveness. And frankly, the intellectual caliber of the students has gone down. I want to talk fairly extensively about an article that I have here about what kids are reading nowadays, or maybe more precisely, what they're not reading. Because they're not reading. It was pulling eye teeth to get my students, to read even a novel. And let me just ask you, how many books you've read in the last year? My goal last year was to read 50. I don't think I hit that unless you count reading children's books to my kids, which I probably read over 100 to, you know, these small kids, small books like Bill Peet or Where the Wild Things Are or The Adventures of Isabel. Some really, really, if you want a list of really, really good books to read to your kids, you can ask me. Email us at drtonyandaustin@gmail.com and I will give you a list because I have one. And so I wanted to read 50 books, and I probably hit somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 some odd. And here it is, today the 19th, and I've finished my first, you know, sizable book. Now, that was an audiobook. Ask me if that counts. I don't know. I'm kind of conflicted about that, because here's the difference between reading an audiobook and reading a regular book for me. When you're reading a book physically in your hand, or even on your Kindle, when you're reading, you have a unanimity of purpose. You have to have your eyes on the page and your hands on the book, which by its nature precludes the possibility of you engaging in a lot of other things, like typically, hopefully, driving. Let me hope, okay, that I confess I've been guilty of driving down the road and reading a book, all right, a physical book. Probably not wisdom there. Curiosity is outstripping wisdom there. But you are forced to focus on that book. Now, tell me if that's true with an audiobook, that I could listen to an audiobook yesterday while I was shoveling snow off someone's driveway. That's how I spent my time. Now, you could say that shoveling snow is a fairly mindless activity, and so my mind, which would otherwise be less occupied than it was when I was listening to an audiobook, my mind is kind of in neutral when I'm shoveling snow. So it's fine to put it in gear and listen to a book while I'm doing it. And not all books are equal whenever you try and read them versus listening to them. Like, it's very difficult for me, it's much more difficult anyway, for me to listen to a nonfiction book via audio than it is for me to listen to a novel. You probably know the reasons for that. I have suspicions, but I don't have them clear in my mind. About, it's just easier for me to follow a story than an argument. And generally in nonfiction, they're making some sort of case that following logical predicate. And it's easier, because of the disjointedness, I have to listen in multiple settings. It's just easier for me to lose track. Plus, the process of recursion or going back and rereading, the process is much more difficult with audio. And so it gets a little bit more muddled. You can do it, but for me, if I'm reading a book, I remember where on the page something was. It's like, I have a question about that thing. I know that it was near the beginning of the chapter, so I go back to the beginning of the chapter. That's harder to find that on audio. It just is. And so you end up having to listen to larger sections if you want to revisit something. I think they're different experiences. Obviously, there are different modalities, but I think the experience is shallower with an audiobook. And I think that there's something that happens with reading a physical book that doesn't happen with an audiobook. So I'm going to put them in different categories, but my calculation that I've made in terms of many of the books that I read, listen to, are via audio anymore, because I don't have the time that I would that I wish I had. Like, I'm working a lot of the time, and when I go home, I'm fathering, I'm parenting, and working around the house, and so I just don't have the leisure time that I had when it was just me and Megan, and even more so when it was just me as a college student. I read books and read books and read books, and boy, did I come up reading books. Our family was a reading family, and I don't read like I used to, like I want to. And so my hope is, and you can tell me if I'm right in this expectation, but my hope is that someday, you know, once the kids have grown and get established, that I'll have a little bit more leisure time to be able to read. This is the whole premise of Ray Bradbury's book, Fahrenheit 451, is that there will come a day, this is a future dystopian society, that there will come a day in which it is not that people have been told or forced not to read. They gave up reading on their own because there was no appetite for reading or for the deep thinking that reading requires. Ray Bradbury says that we need leisure time. You need long blocks of uncommitted time to sit on your front porch and read a book. And that does something super important for the social contract. It forces people to think about things. I mean, listen, I just finished Divergent, okay? Divergent is just, if you could put that in almost in Pulp Fiction, I mean, it's a flash in the pan. It's not an enduring book, okay? You won't be reading it in 50 years. But take a listen to this quote that I got from Divergent. This is a philosophical thing, something you can sink your teeth into. Listen to this. Those who want power and get it live in terror of losing it. That's why we must give power to those who do not want it. I've been saying this for years, that I will vote for politicians who don't want to be politicians. That's not what they want to be. Because it insulates them, that distaste for politics insulates them from corruption when they get there. And plus, it insulates them from making that a career. I don't want career politicians. I don't think that's good for the social contract. I don't think that's a good thing for a healthy society, for people to get up there and get on the gravy train and then stay on it for 30, 40 years. I think they lose touch with what's going on Main Street.
Term limits, baby.
Yeah, I've advocated for that for years. I think it'll be good for us. We got to take a break. I'll come back. But do you see what I'm saying? That in a simple novel, you can interact with ideas like this, like super important. I found term limits in Divergent, for crying out loud. All right, Bill has called in this morning. Bill, can I pilot on you? I just love saying this. I actually say this to Tony, but I want to try my Bill imitation. Will you let me do that before you say good morning? Here goes, okay?
Good morning, Dr. Beam.
It goes like this. A very good morning to you, Mr. Austin. Was that a good?
Any attempt by you with the intent to be fair, an attempt to try to make me seem more important than I am, I'm most grateful and flattered. A very good morning to you, Mr. Austin.
I love that. Thanks, Bill.
Let me again commend you. I know you have passed your probational period, and it was very smart of Dr. Bean to hire you. But still, you risk coming in here in the morning to enlighten us, and I want to thank your wife and your children for sharing you with us for these hours per week that you do. And you do. It's very hard to work with and for a person who is a lobbyist for political institutions, and I think you do it very well, and I thank Dr. Beam for allowing you to do so.
You're very kind.
Now, I would like for you, that quote, I want to hear that again, about those who seek power in a political way. Mm-hmm. Could you repeat that? Because then I have something I want to share with that.
Sure. Yeah, it goes like this. Those who want power and get it live in terror of losing it. That's why we must give power to those who do not want it.
Right. And I have heard this quote by someone mm-hmm. who said that wisdom is not only what we experience and learn for ourselves, but our willingness to listen to others that we may learn from. And I want to say that you are doing a great job by bringing Mr. Robertson in. And since I have called in and kind of curious why Dr. Beam kind of attacked him on this whistle thing that was not this dog whistle. Dr. Beam, really, I thought, and I said this to him publicly, mm-hmm. I didn't think it was an insult to him, but I was wondering, will you all, I mean, we learn from others if we're willing to learn from others. That's wisdom. And since we have Chairman McKissick on every Tuesday, I thought, and I would assume, I'm being presumptuous here, that it was you who was inviting Mr. Robertson on, but since that time, he hasn't been on. Because we like to, I'm willing to listen to him and see what I can learn from him, as you are so kind to introduce us each week to Chairman McKissick. Help me to understand. I mean, is his time with you all over? He deems to Chairman Robertson.
Yeah, I appreciate the question.
You don't have to elaborate on it.
Bill, yeah, I only have a minute until I have to hit the news, so I'll try and be brief in my response. I am very committed to bipartisanship, and I think we see way less of it anymore than we need. And so a return to bipartisanship would be a welcome thing to me. The longer we had Trav on, and yes, it was my invitation that got him on the show, the longer we had him on, the more I felt like he wasn't being open to honest questions and honest inquiry and just being fair-minded. That's what I appreciated about him at the start. But it eventually turned into just an opportunity for him to air liberal talking points. And so I have not uninvited him or disinvited him from the show. He's welcome back on. I haven't reached out to him in a couple weeks, and maybe I'll do that again. But I don't give this microphone to somebody just to let them air those talking points. Does that bring some clarity?
It brings honesty, and that's what you were in your explanation.
Appreciate it, Bill. We'll be back in 5 minutes after the bad news.